You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. When I started planning Mysteries and Monsters 4 years ago, I created a list of people I'd hoped to get a chance to speak with. Most of them I've managed to speak with, and a lot of them seem pleased to return, but I've still got a few on that original list. My guest today was one of those people who appeared on that original list and makes his first appearance. Host of the fabulous Beast Hunter and Legend Hunter shows, wildlife biologist, cryptozoologist, and now author, Pat Spain joins me. We cover some of his expeditions whilst filming for both of the shows, as they travel the globe on the hunt for monsters, some of the hair-raising experiences he had whilst filming, and dive into the new books that should be hitting the bookshelves as we speak. But before we get to Pat, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to all my patrons, but especially to my two latest ones, Nick and Aaron. Thank you both very much. You can also click the link on the show notes to join the team. Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms, so find us on whichever you prefer. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com. Episodes, news, and merchandise, just in time for Christmas. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. Brennan Storr is the producer from the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. A man whose great-uncle was Charles Fort could hardly not carry on the family traditions of questioning everything, and I'm delighted to question Pat some more. I'm delighted to welcome wildlife biologist, cryptozoologist, author, adventurer, speaker, and television presenter, Pat Spain, the great-nephew of the legendary Charles Fort. Pat has continued the family tradition by always questioning science and retaining an open mind in the search of mysteries around the world. Pat, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
I'm so happy to be on the show. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, well, I'm delighted to speak to you. You're one of those people, when I first drew up my plans to create this show, 4 or 5 years ago, Pat, you were in my top 10 of people I was always wanting to speak to. So I've got a massive tick on that list I originally started with, because you're someone that I've been aware of in a professional capacity for over a decade now, since Beast Hunter was shown over here in the UK through Nat Geo. But you're someone that's had a long love of working in the world of biology and animals, because I know you were one of the first people who sort of embraced YouTube as a younger person, as we all were back then, Pat. Filming yourself doing crazy things that kind of opened up the world of media to you to sort of run in tangent with your love of animals around the world, really.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for the kind words. And I've got to say, I'm a huge fan of the show as well. So I'm really, really psyched to be on. And I wish that you'd reached out to me earlier in the 5 years, but I'm psyched that it worked out now. So thank you. And yeah, that's absolutely right. So I've always been fascinated by wildlife and the kind of the stranger, the better, the more mysterious. It really drew me to the oceans at a young age. And that's why I majored in marine biology and was just fascinated by how much we don't know about the world around us. And I had this penchant for cryptids. You know, I didn't even know the term cryptid at the time. We're going back to the 80s. And I was reading, you know, some all different books, some of the classics, and, you know, was familiar with a whole bunch of Lauren Coleman stuff and all that. And Charles Fort. And my grandmother saw me reading one of the Charles Fort books one day and said, you know, that's your Uncle Charlie. For years, she had compared me to Uncle Charlie, and I never knew who this was. I just kind of thought it was my grandmother, you know, teasing me a little bit about my strange interests.
Yeah.
And it all of a sudden dawned that this is actually what our family has been doing, you know, for a couple generations now. So it was really fascinating, really, really a cool kind of connection for me. And that made me really dig in even more. So I went to school for marine bio. I loved getting people excited about wildlife, and that usually involves a high tolerance for pain. I'd be getting bitten by things while I'm giving presentations. And it was my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, who suggested to try TV. She's like, you know, I know that you're harmless, but the people that you're giving these talks to, I see parents getting a little bit worried about this, you know, 22-year-old kid who's talking to my children about, you know, rattlesnakes. And so she suggested to try, you know, TV. So I drove to Ohio. I auditioned for a wildlife show on Animal Planet, and I ended up getting on this reality show, and it gave me a kind of taste for it, that this is the way that I can reach the biggest audience. And as you said, this is the early days of YouTube. So I formed I put up flyers around Boston. I found some camera people. I roped some of my best friends and my girlfriend into it, and we started filming our own wildlife show. And for about 8 years, I spent all of my money and more, got myself crazy in debt, just flying all over the world filming this wildlife show. And it's kind of a precursor to, you know, the Brave Wilderness that we see today with Coyote Peterson, who's just amazing. He does such a great job with it, but really has perfected it in a way. And this is something that, you know, I was just really passionate about doing. And that led to a whole bunch of pilots and a bunch of, you know, one-off shows, and eventually to Beast Hunter.
I was always impressed with Beast Hunter.
Oh, thank you.
Because it wasn't just about monsters, Pat. The thing that I've always enjoyed about your work is that you take the time to actually immerse yourself into the local culture. And I'm going to touch on a particular incident, which I think is probably your famous excerpt that's available for anybody to view on YouTube. And it still made me chuckle. I rewatched it the other week because I hadn't seen it for a couple of years. Not that I was laughing at you, Pat. I was laughing
at
you.
No, it's totally fine. Everyone, it's good to laugh.
it takes the pain away. So was that a conscious decision? Because the two things I always really thought made Beast Hunter stand out more than most shows about monsters was, firstly, as I say, you immerse yourself in the local culture and you like to try a variety of weird and wonderful food substances and get to know the people and move around and sort of see what else was going on there, as well as looking at what was actually going on in the fact that these weren't the normal kind of creatures. Because I know the episode you do on sea serpents, everybody would think, oh, you'd do Nessie or Champ, but you did Caddy instead, which I thought was really refreshing. And was that something you had much input into, Pat, when you were creating the series, or did it just fall like that, as often happens in TV?
No, so one of the things that I really, really loved about Beast Hunter and continue is Icon Films. So Icon Films is the production company behind Beast Hunter. They're the production company behind Legend Hunter and River Monsters and Monster Rivers and all of Hazen Audell's stuff, where he's doing, you know, Survive the Tribe and Primal Survivor and Escape the Amazon. So Icon Films was my dream. When I was first getting into TV and I was looking at who I wanted to work with, they were the absolute top of my list. If I could work with anybody in the world, it would be Icon Films. And I actually got the opportunity to do it, and I've never looked back. It's a handshake deal. I mean, of course, we signed contracts, but I have continued to, you know, do everything in my power to support them. They support me. They're just an absolutely amazing organization. And when we were planning Beast Hunter, it was a complete collaborative effort. So I worked with the executive producer, Harry, and the series producer, Barney, and we came up with a list of the 15 cryptids that, you know, I would be the most interested in looking for and I thought would make the best episodes. And we took those to Nat Geo, and I worked collaboratively with Nat Geo, talking about the 15 and paring it down to the five that we did. And it was just an incredible experience, and I really feel like there was great input in there. And it was so much fun. You know, I got to talk about the things that are passionate to me, and I got to see the other side of TV also, because that list of 15, there was different, you know, criteria for them that I never would have thought of. It was, well, you know, we're going to have this air at this time, and we're also going to have another show that's, you know, all about the jungles of Borneo. So we don't want to film anything in Borneo because we don't want two of those on at the same time. And it was like, oh, I didn't know that. Cool. All right. and it was, you know, so there was a lot of that, but it was always driven by that, you know, that original list that that we had come up with, you know, Icon and myself. Hmm. So we did absolutely got the input into there. And as far as the bullet ants go, that was my it was my idea.
Oh, Pat.
Yeah, so it's something where, again, working with Icon, I knew that I'd have opportunities that I would never have any other time in my life or anywhere else. So I kind of came up with not just a list of the animals I wanted to look for, but the list of the things that I thought would be the most intriguing for someone to watch and for me to do. And, you know, one of those was going down in a sub in Canada. So being able to go down, you know, 1,000 feet underwater in a 3-man sub was a dream come true for this marine bio nerd. But another one on the list was the bullet ants, not because I wanted to do it, but because I knew that I needed, in order to do the show, as you described, as you said, to get, you know, really embedded in the local cultures. We're only filming for 15 days. Mm. There are people who spend years and aren't accepted into the tribes. I mean, these are people who have not been treated very well by outsiders and who are rightfully distrustful. But I need them to tell me stories and legends and tell me the truth, not just tell me the kind of surface level, but really. So what's the fastest way that I can show them that I respect them? You know, what's the thing that I can do that will show them the most amount of respect? Well, in most cases, it's eat with them. It's, you know, participate in daily activities, help them rebuild part of, you know, something that was damaged in a storm. It's the daily life stuff. Mm. But in this particular case with this particular group, my idea was that it would be the bullet ants. It would be, this is how I show them that I truly respect your culture and that I want to know about this and I want to experience it, not in a, you know, over the top kind of, you know, stunt type of way, but just in a way that this is normal for you and I want to experience that as well. And it worked.
So for anybody who doesn't know about bullet ants, Pat, can you give us a quick synopsis about this particular trial and why it is classed as a real sort of coming of age process for these people? Because I think when you watch the footage and you see what happens, I think some people might not really understand what's going on here, because it's, I suppose it's one of those, it's only television, and thankfully you got through it. That's not the end of the episode, but goodness me, you were hanging on to reality at one day.
Oh, it's wild. So the actual footage, you see about 10 minutes of what was really a multi-week ordeal. and so what it is the Satare Mawe tribe in Brazil. They're fascinating and amazing people, ancient history, just such cool stories. And they're the first to cultivate guarana. They're just amazing in every way. Mm. But this particular ritual is, it's called the Tucundera ceremony. And it involves getting stung hundreds of times in your hands by bullet ants, which have the worst sting of any insect in the world. The most painful sting. They also call them the 24-hour ant because the pain lasts for 24 hours. I found out it's actually much longer than that. But they're called bullet ants because of both their size, about the size of a bullet, and it feels like you've been shot from one sting. People die from one sting. And one of our producers at Icon had been stung on her face in the late 80s when she was down in Peru, I believe, and she could still at a point to the exact spot and recall the pain intensely from that one sting. So this ritual, it's really it's a part of the tribe, and what they do is they have to do this ritual 20 times over the course of their life if they want to be a hunter. Mm. And a hunter is the highest position in the tribe. So this is, you know, the ultimate job. This is the top position. So not everyone does it. Some people that do it only do it once or twice and then decide they're never going to do it again.
Yeah.
But those that go through this 20 times, they are hunters. And the reason for it seems extreme, and it seems like it doesn't make sense until you're actually down there. And then you realize that hunters are putting themselves at risk every day in an extremely hostile and difficult environment. And if you're going out in the middle, you know, you're on a day and a half out into the Amazon rainforest and you get gored by a wild pig. Mm. If you've never done the bullet ants, you might think, I'm dead. This is it. I'm done. I'm going to lay down and die. But if you've done the bullet ants 20 times, you go, yeah, I'm going to walk it off. And I actually found this. I found a way to harness this ability in my everyday life. So after completing filming, I was unfortunately diagnosed with cancer, and I had massive complications. I was in the hospital for about 2 months. My intestines ruptured. I went septic. I had to be put in a medically induced coma. And during this time, every day the doctors would come in every few hours, and they'd ask you to rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10. And I'm on a morphine drip. I'm on everything you can think of. And I'd be hunched over, barely able to speak. And they said that I was the only patient they ever had who never rated their pain at a 10. They're like, at the most pain you were ever in, you'd give yourself a 9, but usually, 7 or 8. And they're like, you're the only one. I said, that's because I felt a 10.
I know. Yeah, I know what a 10 really is.
Yeah. Yeah. So I understood. I understood why this ritual exists. It's that, people who have never pushed themselves to a 10 don't know what that is, and they're in a lot more danger in the forest than someone who has.
Mm. I think as well, it's one of those things when you watch these types of programs, Pat, that sometimes your host or the person that you're going on these adventures with doesn't normally do these kind of things, because usually the producers will say, what the hell are you doing? And I think the thing about that is that obviously this pain was so intense, you, for a little bit, seemed to be hallucinating, because you kept saying to people, take the gloves off, but you weren't wearing the gloves at that point, were you?
Oh, no, I completely lost my mind. I lost my grip on reality. I screamed uncontrollably for about an hour. I headbutted our producer. Oh. I tackled our sound technician. I went in and out of consciousness. I have, whole hallucinations. I wrote about it pretty extensively in the books.
Yes.
But it was absolutely just the strangest experience I've ever had in my life. But it's really just the pain. Mm. It's the pain that pushes you to that. The venom actually isn't really doing any damage. Mm. It's just kind of tricking your mind into thinking that you're in this you are in this massive amount of pain, but it's not from actual damage that's being done to you.
Mm. I must admit, I've never seen anybody so happy to put their hands into an ice bath.
Yeah, and that. So we did ask beforehand, what was acceptable and what wasn't.
Yeah.
And they basically told us that, after the first 4 hours, you can do what you want. Yeah. They said you can take pain meds, but it's not going to work. They said most people get really drunk. Most people who do it just after the 4 hours, they just get, blackout drunk. But they said ice works really well. So I went, oh, well, we've got ice. Let's try this. So they broke out the cooler of ice, and we brought the other three guys who did it with me onto the boat also.
Mm.
And all of us put our hands in the ice and just crying. But the second you took your hands out of the ice, it went away. So
yeah.
We had a doctor who was with us, and he got more concerned with me having my hands in ice for 16 hours than because he said, I actually lost a couple layers of skin. He was worried about all kinds of rot and things like that. So they had to watch me, ice, no ice, ice, no ice. But yeah, it was wild. My wife, we spoke before, and she, she just said, kind of be smart about it. Like, if you do it, just be smart about it, essentially. And I called her, as soon as I was kind of coherent again. And she was shocked that I had actually done it and glad that I had made it through.
So how long did it take until it began to really subside? Because as you say, obviously this was a Brazilian 24 hours, Pat, that they told you it'd last for. So how long was it till you started sort of feeling normal, if such a thing is possible after that kind of experience?
It was a good 16 hours before I was coherent again.
Mm.
And then it was probably another, 16 or so hours before I could function.
Yeah.
And then the full use of my hands took another day or two.
Oof. So about 3 days in total then.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, there was still residual PTSD. We saw a bullet ant a few other times on the shoot, and I would just unconsciously recoil and want to run away. But yeah, it was so strange. The hallucinations, part of it was that I was seeing bullet ants everywhere. I was seeing them crawling on people. I was seeing, it was wild. So, that took a little bit more time. Even watching the footage a couple years later, I would still unconsciously clench and unclench my hands.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, I mean, and with the, I love the crew that I worked with the entire time. So, the really great thing was that it got me absolutely no special treatment after the first day. It was still like, you're going to lug all your own stuff. You're going to pack all your own stuff. It was, yeah. Get on with it. We gave you a day of rest. That's all you get. Here we go.
Yeah, and,
that was the right way to do it. And that, it was great, but I was dyed blue. I was navy blue for about 4 or 5 days. And, the crew kind of got sick of all the attention that it would bring with, you know, people recognizing that I had done the Tucandera. Uh-huh. So we were at this rural airport about to go into, Redonia. And one of the people there, one of the people working asked our translator, they're like, why is your friend blue? And she just rolled her eyes and goes, oh, he's from Boston. Like, as if that was the explanation that, and they just went, oh, okay. That was it.
Now, obviously, you were there because you were looking after, as we've said about one of the things that separates Beast Hunter from many programs of its ilk, Pat, was the choice of creatures. And this was all about the incredible stories that were coming out of the Brazilian Amazon, especially in regards to the Mapinguari, which is a really strange creature. And I really enjoyed the thought process of this, because with your knowledge and your experience in marine biology, I think obviously you can look at bringing some of that skill set into regards to the search for cryptids, because a lot of them do have some kind of footing in reality or real creatures. Obviously, people will always sort of point to things like the Orang Pendek, which we'll touch on in a bit, and and the Tasmanian tiger, because these are creatures that aren't dissimilar or we know have existed in the last 100 years. So, but this one, the descriptions are so odd that we know it can't, well, you would hope that it can't possibly be a real creature based on the description. And yet it's one of those creatures that we look at some kind of muscle memory, customary passing down of information over generations in that particular area, that seems to lend it to a pretty fearsome creature in its own right. And one that some people in the modern era have really begun to think could still possibly exist somewhere out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, the Mapinguari was really one of the top of my list. I mean, all the ones that we came up with were tops of the list, but the Mapinguari was really up there specifically for that. The most interesting thing that I found about it was, you know, when you talk to people in Brazil and in the Amazon region about the Mapinguari, it was almost like they were describing two different animals. So if you were in the city, if you were around people who'd never seen it, didn't know anyone who had seen it or who knew, you know, any type of first or secondhand account of it, they would describe this really monstrous mythical creature, you know, giant with a mouth in its chest. And it's, you know, it's almost this superhero. It's the protector of the rainforest. It's, well, you can't go into the forest and do any damage because the Mapinguari will eat you. But when you talk to people who live on the edges, who live on the, you know, the edges of where it's spotted, or who do know someone who has seen it, or who say that they have seen it themselves, they describe a much more realistic animal. And it really does start to emerge that what they're describing is a giant ground sloth. Mm. And the way to link a giant ground sloth to the myths, you know, the things like the mouth and its chest. Well, we know that, you know, modern day sloths and anteaters, you can see like a V shape on their chest. You know, you think about a tamandua or something, and you see that V that could absolutely look like a mouth. You hear about this horrible stench that could, you know, knock someone out or kill someone from the smell. And it's like, well, okay, again, anteaters, they, you know, they call them the stinkers of the forest. Like, it's just this horrible odor that they emit. So you multiply that by 10 and you have a giant one. I can only imagine. The horrible cry of one, you know, the sound that they make. You hear a mating sloth or a sloth that's looking for a mate, and it's a very surprising noise. Not one that you would expect to come from this animal. Mm. And, you know, same thing with anteaters. And then they talk about the, you know, the unpenetrable back. Like, it's, you know, the only place where it can be hurt is by hitting it in this, you know, this one particular spot on its belly. And when we look at the remains of giant ground sloths, we see osteoderms. You see like bony plates, bony little like nubs almost all around them, except on this one place on their stomach. And it's like, oh, this all starts to make sense and seem much more like a real animal. And the potential for it to be surviving into the present era, the most fascinating thing about that is all of these stories of the Mapinguari involve if you hear it, you die. If you hear it, you die. If you hear it, you die. Well, the reality from people who live in that region, it's not if you hear it, you die. It's if you hear it, your life changes forever because this animal is so revered and treated as so other than anything else that if you hear this, you have to move. You can't ever go back to the place where it was heard. So by doing that, you know, we're talking about uncontacted or very, very sparsely contacted tribes with the Western world. So they are very protected by the Brazilian government, as they should be, 100%. We had to get special permission. We had to have medical exams to go in, and we weren't seeing uncontacted tribes. So these regions are protected. Westerners, outsiders can't go in there. So if you have a group of people who there's already protections, they are essentially creating nature reserves by vacating areas where this animal has been heard. And if this has been going on for generations and generations, it's entirely possible that an isolated population could be in this area.
I mean, the thing about this is as well is that the general consensus, Pat, is that the ground sloth as it was probably passed away 9,000-10,000 years ago. But we also seem to have now uncovered that a population carried on, as often happens. It seems we've learnt this quite fairly recently in regards to mammoths, that everybody thought they'd died out about the same time, and then we realised that there's a particular island in Alaska where I think they're saying maybe 3,000 years ago now, I think, something like that. So,
no, I've read that. It's fascinating.
Yeah. It seems that there's a very similar changing of the story in regards to this. And I think, as you say there, we're dealing with a particular area of the world, because often people say, well, how can any creature like this exist still in the wild? We've mapped everywhere. We've been everywhere. But we know that's not true. And I often find it seems to be one of these things that's put forward in the mainstream, regardless of it being an academic train of thought, Pat, or a general thought that the public will have, that there are still large expanses, especially when you talk about places in the Amazon or particular areas in the Pacific Rim, those kinds of areas where there isn't much exploration, really, because we've got so many political and tribal issues that don't allow us to visit there. These people live there. But we can't just turn up, as you say here, these reservations that are there in the Amazon. Nobody can contact these tribes. They are away from us. They are protected. They are removed from our influence, as it were.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of wild places left in the world. And it's hard to imagine sitting, you know, in England or in the United States. It's hard to think about that there are still wild places where Westerners haven't been, or at least do not go with any frequency to be able to say that they've seen this, that they've seen everything that lives there. We're still finding new primate species. I mean, the snub-nosed macaque in Myanmar was just found, what, like 8 years ago, something like that. There's been new primate species that have been identified in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. So there is still a lot to find, and a lot of these species are in the protected regions, are in the regions where, you know, it's either extremely difficult to get to. You know, there are regions of Brazil that it's just very, very hard to traverse over land. And if you don't have, if the Amazon isn't a way to get there, then it's really hard to get there. If you're not jumping off the boat and you're there, then it becomes very, very difficult. So there's physical barriers, there's political barriers, and, I mean, flying over somewhere, you're never going to see what's in those trees. You're never going to see what's in that forest. Even with drone technology, you're not sending drones 15 miles out into, you know, uncontacted tribes.
Yeah. I think it is one of those aspects because, I mean, as we speak today, the news has broken that they've rediscovered a pheasant that they thought was extinct for 140 years. And this always seems to happen that people, once again, as we talk about our love of mystery creatures and cryptids, that people still seem to be surprised when things like this turn up. As I mentioned earlier, the Tasmania tiger, I think was it the Papua New Guinea singing dog, which they thought didn't exist anymore. They'd stumbled across a new population of that, and they've suddenly realised that they're a lot more resilient than people thought, Pat. And this seems to keep happening, and yet people keep saying, no, we're not discovering new animals, or that even the tortoises in the Galapagos that Forrest Galland rediscovered.
Yeah.
They were hiding in plain sight. It's just nobody decided to pick one up and have a proper look at it.
Right. No, and that's absolutely the case. Yes, there are still a lot. I forget what the statistic was. There was some really fascinating number that I read. It was something like 90% of all mammal species that we've believed were extinct have been found to still be alive. I mean, it was some mind-blowing number. Maybe it was 80, but it was a much higher number than I would have guessed. And what it really shows you is that extinction isn't usually an event. Extinction is a process. Yeah. And there's a huge difference between functionally extinct and extinct in the wild and absolute. Like, extinct does not necessarily mean that there aren't a few still alive.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things. Like, I think dinosaurs is a tougher sell. Millions of, I mean, other than birds, of course, we know birds are dinosaurs, but non-avian dinosaurs, an animal that went extinct millions of years ago is a much tougher sell than an animal that went extinct in quotes 10,000 years ago. Because as you said, I mean, there was a ground sloth population that survived on the island of Hispaniol until hundreds of years ago. And I mean, who's to say that there aren't some left in some forested region? And I think that if we're looking at, you know, where their range was and where we have today with not much contact, the Brazilian rainforest is a pretty good spot.
Absolutely. I mean, you only have to look at that particular area, Central and South America, Pat. There are cities that have disappeared in the last 500 years there that are only just being rediscovered. Some of the work that I've seen going on there when they're looking at Inca and Aztec civilizations, that it just looks like mountains, but they're not mountains, they're pyramids that have just, trees have grown over them, and they've only just realized what's going on here. And we're talking, you know, we're not talking about settlements, we're talking about massive cities here, which are jaw-dropping in their complexity. And one of those things that often gets put forward is, oh, well, these people, they all had strange beliefs. And then you look at what they built and how they built it and where they built it and how they were able to survive for so long. And it just brings up more questions than answers, because then you begin to think, well, why did they all go then? If they built this here, what caused them to leave? Was it some kind of ecological disaster? Did the water go funny? There are so many things. And yet, if enormous pyramids built somewhere, Pat, can vanish, I'm sure it's not going to be too hard for a population of ground sloths to keep themselves away from those people that seem to hunt them.
I totally agree. I absolutely agree. And that's what I think is so fascinating. And that's what I think it's such a shame when, you know, people write this stuff off, write it off without even looking, without even thinking any further than that. It's really, it's an arrogant way of thinking, I think, I believe. It's, thinking that we know everything, we're proved time and time again to be wrong. Whenever
yes.
we think we know everything, history has shown us that, you know, we don't.
I mean, how did you find, as you've touched on there when we're jokingly mentioning dinosaurs, this is one of those things that I'd heard about these stories, and obviously as a child and a teenager, Pat, I was well immersed in my love of monsters. So as I kind of left it alone for a while until I came back, I wasn't aware of how prevalent this theory had started being in regards to that. Because there are two particular creatures that people look for around the world. One is obviously Mekele Mbembe in the Congo Basin region. And the other one is the Ropen out in the Pacific.
Yes.
Now, these, for a variety of reasons that I'm not really going to explain why certain people are looking for these particular creatures. However, because that's a whole, I could do a whole show on that particular train of thought. But Pat, this is one of those strange things that it seems preposterous to some people that we would have a population of dinosaurs that have managed to survive into the modern era undiscovered, especially when it comes to Mekele Mbembe. We're talking about a bloody large dinosaur as well. You know, we're not talking about some small raptor that's managed to squirrel itself away in some jungle somewhere. We're talking about creatures that are apparently known for stopping rivers due to their size. So,
yeah.
I mean, that alone, when you go to a place like that, dealing with all this sort of baggage about these stories and the reasons that some people are out there desperately looking for these dinosaurs, it's strange that when I first realized what was going on in those particular cases, I was like, goodness me. Because I just thought they were people talking about some strange creature they'd seen. And it was one of those that perhaps it had been misinterpreted or mistranslated into English, and we were looking for something that wasn't what we thought it was.
Yeah, that's another one of the reasons why I love Beast Hunter so much is because – so we were never looking to prove that the animal exists as described. We were looking to see, you know, what is the cultural significance of this animal? Why is this animal important? What else could it be? So there's always that mistaken identity aspect of it. And, you know, why does this story persist, really? And I found – I believe that I found that in West Africa. So we went to Cameroon, the Congo, and the Central African Republic. And what I found is that I went there. I did not think that I was going to find a dinosaur. I did not find a dinosaur.
Oh, spoiler.
Well, yeah, but what I did find was, you know, an absolute reason for this story to persist. And I think that, you know, Darren Naish really touches on this in his book on, you know, Searching for Monsters. Yes. About this need, this, you know, this cultural, you know, the cultural significance of it, and how, you know, cryptozoology is kind of a mix of anthropology and biology. And I fully embrace and agree with that. Mm-hmm. And in this case, what I found is that this is, you know, the peoples that we were living with in West Africa, this is a very, very rough terrain, and it's a rough way to survive. Mm. We did not see very many young children or old people, which, you know, tells you it's a pretty harsh environment. It's a pretty harsh way of life. And they really, really pride themselves on strength.
Yeah.
On strength and courage. And they are. They are amazingly strong and amazingly courageous. And I was blown away on a daily basis by, you know, the things that I would see and the activities. But one of the things that really struck me is we would talk about crocodiles. We would talk about hippos, and every, you know, across the board, the people that we would speak with, I'm not afraid of those. I'm not afraid of those. You can't do they. If I have my spear, they can't touch me. If I'm on my boat, they can't touch me. You mentioned Mekele Mbembe. Oh, no, you got to stay away from there. So it almost became this culturally accepted, like, if you're afraid of a crocodile, then you're looked at as weak. Mm. If you're afraid of Mekele Mbembe, you're looked at as smart.
Yeah.
So, you know, the rivers present a lot of dangers. Most of the fishermen can't swim. Mm. It's really dangerous to be on a sampan, which is, you know, this dugout canoe that's really unstable. It's dangerous to be on there under the best of situations. Yeah. But most of the times that Mekele Mbembe is quote unquote spotted, it's when the river is at its worst. It's when the river is moving really, really quickly. There's rapids. There's, you know, changes in it due to, you know, the climate changing. There's, you know, it's at night. Mm. It's times when it's dangerous to be out there. So it's almost this culturally accepted boogeyman to say we should avoid the river right now because of Mekele Mbembe. Mm. And everyone goes, yes, you're right. Mm.
Do you think as well, often outsiders will look at some of these creatures and the people that talk about them quite freely, Pat, and sort of dismiss them as people who are very uneducated. But as you say there, these people are very aware of all the animals that live around them. They know what they do, how they can survive them, how to deal with them. Because for us that live in the West, and the only time most of us come up against a creature that can take your life is when we visit a zoo or a safari park. We're protected from that. But these people live amongst them and still have a level of respect and understanding about these creatures and what they can and can't do that often I think it shows that kind of arrogance, as you referred to earlier, that we dismiss some of these stories from people because of who they are and the fact that we don't think that they have the knowledge to understand the world around them, which is clearly nonsense.
Totally, totally. I think my two favorite quotes on that, one was from a guy named Mutt Merritt, who was my boss at an oyster hatchery that I worked on down in Maryland. And Mutt's just an amazing guy. He's a, you know, he has his, you know, PhD, but he goes by Mutt. He insists that that is his name. Right. And Mutt said to me, you know, absolutely flat out, if you want to know about oysters, don't talk to the scientists, go and talk to the fishermen. Mm. And I was like, what? Because they rely on these, you know, for their livelihood. That's it. They can tell you everything about the water. They can tell you what, you know, when the fish are running, what species of fish. They may not know the Latin name for it, but they can tell you everything about the water. And the other one was from an individual that we were working with in Sumatra, and we were talking about orang pendek, and I kept on throwing out all these mistakes. Well, you know, could it be an orangutan? Could it be a gibbon? Could it be a blah, blah, blah? Mm. And this person finally kind of laughed and put their head back, and they said, look it, the people who don't believe in a Ring Pendek are the people who've never been to my forest.
Mm.
I was like, fair. Yep, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Orang Pendek for me is probably one of the most tantalizing ones, because it's clearly, when you speak to the people who live out there, they can tell you exactly what it isn't, Pat. Oh, and yeah. That, for me, says that there's clearly something, because nobody's saying these are people running about. They are telling that it is a distinctly different type of creature that they encounter fairly regularly. And I think we only, even as we mentioned there, when we talk about orangutans, as we've just been saying about some other creatures that we've learned so much about over the last 20 years, we now know that orangutans aren't all the same species. They're slightly different. There are changes in them. And yet, some people wouldn't know that, because once again, it's the perception of a particular creature, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, and the way that they talk about Orang Pendek in Sumatra, it's with the people that I was speaking with were amazed that I wanted to talk about Orang Pendek. They wanted to talk about tigers because they have this kind of mythical association with tigers, and tigers almost bridge the spiritual and the real world for them. So it was like, oh, Orang Pendek? Yeah, no, that's normal. Let's talk about tigers. You should be filming tigers. This is what you should be focused on. And they're like, oh, Orang Pendek, well, our grandparents saw it a lot more than we did. But yeah, it's there. It's not a big deal. Let's talk about tigers. And I just thought that take was so interesting. It was really like, it was just treated, you know, they're glad that it's there. They were like, oh, a ton of animals have gone extinct, you know, since my grandparents were little. And unfortunately, Orang Pendek is probably one of those. Let's talk about tigers. And that was really how it was treated, was just with this like nonchalance. Like, it's, yeah, of course it's there. It's there. Gibbons are there. You know, rhinoceros are there. You know, tapirs are there. And it would just be listed along with all of the other species that you might come across. And it was like, well, where can we find an Orang Pendek? And they're like, I don't know. In the forest? Like, where can you find a tapir? I don't know. In the forest. So it was just this total nonchalance. And the just the normalcy of it, as you said, was really striking to me with Orang Pendek, and how it wasn't even a story. It's just treated like one of the other animals that are there. But as you also said, they can really tell you what it isn't. And, you know, I went in thinking, you know, gibbon or orangutan, and the differences are striking. I mean, it would be, I don't believe that anyone that I met with would have mistaken a gibbon or an orangutan for an Orang Pendek in the way that they were describing it. Just the behaviors, the food sources, the where you find them, the look of them, everything about it is a distinct animal. And after talking to Mike Morwood, I was absolutely totally in the camp of, yes, it was still there, at least until very recently. And if it has gone extinct, it's because logging and habitat destruction due to rubber plantations and other things, palm oil plantations rather, and rubber plantations. And there may still be a few aging individuals out there, but probably, unfortunately, not a sustainable population. But I do still think it was there a couple decades ago.
Well, fingers crossed. As we said earlier, we've been proved wrong when we've talked about normal animals, Pat. So let's hope the Orang Pendek in that gang.
Absolutely, I agree.
I think one of the other creatures, before I move on to Legend Hunter, if that's all right with you, is one of the countries I've always wanted to visit, and I just find it jaw-dropping. I have done for a long, long time, is Mongolia. And some of the culture there and the landscapes, the Gobi Desert, is one of those desolately beautiful places, Pat. I've had the honour of visiting the Sahara, only briefly, but enough to make me in awe of nature, because I only went about 4 hours in, and that was it. There was nothing. I couldn't see anything other than sand. And it was just like, I'm literally just an inch into this, really, in the reality of the size of this place. And yet it was just like I'd gone to another planet. So when you look at Mongolia, the stories of the Mongolian death worm, I think the name doesn't help this creature. Because when you speak to the tribes people there, they seem, once again, as we've said about some of these other creatures, they're very matter of fact about it. They don't pretend it's electrocuting people and spitting out bolts of lightning at people. I think the more we talk about it, this is another one where I think that the description and its name kind of gives an impression of creature that can't possibly exist, when I think when we look at it properly, this might be some kind of venomous salamander more than anything, that we've just kind of created a monstrous version of it.
Yeah, everything you said. Yes, so the Gobi is gorgeous and desolate, and you feel like you're on another planet, more so than anywhere else I've been other than the bottom of the ocean. It's the biggest contrast with what I see on a day-to-day basis, or anywhere else I've been for that matter. We were walking around in the desert and saw dinosaur eggs on the ground. I mean, where else can that happen? Just a nest of dinosaur eggs right there on the ground.
Yeah.
So it was absolutely wild. But the death worm itself, yeah, I think it's the greatest name in all of cryptozoology because it's one of those that people hear and you want to know more about. But yes, the reality of it is not, you know, a 20-foot worm. It's the size of a goat's stomach, which is, you know, about 8 inches. It's something that, you know, they talk about it exploding, but they talk about a lot of other animals exploding. They talk about the sound of the electric. And also all of the traits that they associate with it do exist in other real animals. Other animals that have been identified. But the thing that I really found with the Mongolian death worm is that the nomads that we worked with in Mongolia, they have an incredible respect for all life. And, you know, it's a Buddhist country. It's this real deep-seated respect for all life. And it's don't mess with something if you don't have to. Like, it's basically like, leave it alone. Like, if you're, you know, anything that burrows, especially, they're just not familiar with because they're not digging, they're not seeing anything. So they have these stories about pretty much every animal you can think of. I caught a little grass snake there, harmless little grass snake. And the people that we were with freaked out, these big, huge wrestlers, these really tough guys, you know, don't touch that. Absolutely stay away. And I said, why? And they said, well, it coils into a spring and it shoots through the camel that you're riding on and impales you. It's like, okay, tell me more about this. And it strikes really, really quickly. It's really, really fast. And so they kind of build up these stories, but the entire point of all these stories are, you know, don't mess with it if you don't have to. Mm. And that really came through with everything about the death worm. Every story you hear about the death worm killing someone, it's because someone messed with it.
Yeah.
So it's really like this analogy of just leave nature to itself. Like, try to not destroy the desert. Try to not kill animals that you're not going to eat. Don't poke things with a stick. Don't throw gasoline on things.
Yes.
Just leave it be. And I really liked that about this. So I do think that there's something to it. I don't think that it's the electric, you know, acid shooting, exploding, hot blood animal.
Yes.
But I think, as you said, I kind of fell into, you know, maybe there's some type of grub, maybe there's some type of snake, maybe there's an amphisbaenia, some type of other reptile or amphibian. But I do think that there's something undiscovered there, but I don't think that people would not say that it's the Mongolian death worm, even if it was found.
Yeah. I've got a real love of the Mongolian death worm, Pat, because it's the creature that helped out me as a lover of monsters to my normal friends. Because a few years ago, somebody asked my partner to what books I'd be interested in, and she recommended The Beasts That Hide from Man by Carl Schucker.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And when they bought it, they didn't know anything about it. And obviously they were reading it before they wrapped it up to give it to me as a present. And they just went, what on earth's all this about? And I said, what? Have you never heard of the Mongolian death worm? And they just started looking at me sideways. They were like, I couldn't hide anymore after that, Pat. The normal people knew I wasn't normal.
Absolutely. Yep.
So, As I mentioned there, you took a break to recuperate and deal with your cancer diagnosis and the treatment that you had and sort of built yourself back up. You've done a lot of speaking and become a real advocate for a positive mindset in regards to the situation that you had to face down, Pat.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it's something I've kept myself aware of following your work and some of the speeches you do, and it's certainly something that you've taken life with both hands, even more than you could have done, I suspect, because obviously you were quite ill for a while and you were one of those people you didn't really realize you were ill until it really got to a point where it ended up taking you into hospital. So you obviously had to take some time to come to terms with life after your diagnosis and the treatment, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's a day-by-day process. It's still underway, for sure.
So obviously getting back into chasing down wonderful things, it was great to see you come back with Legend Hunter, because once again, this is a real mixture, because it's a show that kind of... It's got a bit of everything. We've got monsters, we've got murders, we've got strange ship. I mean, the Spanish ship story is a very odd one regardless, but it was really good to see once again.
Oh, thank you.
And a nice variety with you sort of testing your wits in some of these particular cases. And I'll start with the elephant in the room, really, because the Beast of Bray Road episode seemed to really upset lots of people.
It did. Yeah, and I'm bummed about that. I really loved it, so I had a lot of fun with it. I think that it was people were thinking that it was going to be Beast Hunter 2, and it wasn't. It's a very different type of show. It's for Travel Channel, and it was a great experience all around. And that show, the really wild thing about that was the first meeting that I had about that was about 5 years before we filmed anything. Mm. And then the course of filming was about 2 years that we were working on that show. So it's really, there's a huge progression and a lot of changes happened over that time. But Travel Channel was amazing to work with. And again, it was Icon Films. So the Beast of Bray Road, it really was, you know, looking at the particular stories that we were hearing from people and looking at what's out there and looking at all of the evidence, looking at, you know, everything that's there, it really did point me towards thinking that, you know, this is a bear with mange. This is these sightings that happened, the particular ones that we saw. I know that there's a lot of other sightings, but that was what it had led me to. That was where the evidence pointed. And I don't think people wanted to hear that. But that was where the evidence led me from the particular instances that we explored. I know that there's a lot more, and there's so many other angles that we could have gone into. One of the gentlemen that we interviewed, he had all these photos. You know, we could have gone this UFO route. He had all kinds of really fascinating and interesting stuff in that. There gets into the supernatural, but one of our kind of guiding principles on Legend Hunter was that we were not going to go supernatural. we were going to keep things grounded in what we can measure with our scientific tools and what we know about biology. So yeah, but I loved that. I had a lot of fun with it, and yeah, it was a cool part of the country that I hadn't been to before. And yeah.
Well, I think it's one of those things that when it comes to the modern cryptids, Pat, the Dog Man phenomenon is something that causes some real problems, because some people are all in on it.
Yes.
And you can't even sort of postulate possibilities for some people. I mean, this is the other aspect. I've spoken with people about this previously, that some people are cast iron. It is a dog man. It is not a werewolf.
Right.
And for some of us, we're like, well, hang on a minute, what's the difference? And they'll say, oh, well, the dog man's got man's eyes and a werewolf doesn't. And you're like, well, hang on a minute, have you seen a werewolf? Because this is that kind of thing where you're saying, well, you're telling me what it can't be, but how do you know what that is? And so when I've spoken with people about this, and I know other people that do other shows and other researchers, they are very careful to step around the dogman thing, because people get really upset if you're not in it. And I've done a couple of episodes, and I've spoken with Linda Godfrey and obviously other people.
Oh, she's awesome. She's great.
And covered it a bit. I have to say, out of all the cryptids in the modern era, it's the one that gives me the most problems, because, you know, I'm certainly no biologist at all. However, I know enough about animals to have a real problem with it, because, as you may be aware, I'm a lover of all things Bigfoot. So
yes,
that for me works more, because I have a rudimentary understanding of evolution of the great apes and primate lineage. So there are throwbacks, you know, we could be going millions of years, but there are things that could possibly pass for what people might be saying.
Sure.
I'm not. This, the Dogman phenomenon, is a completely different kettle of fish, because as far as I'm aware, we've never uncovered bipedal dogs.
No.
So it's that aspect of it, Pat, as someone who likes to consider themselves open-minded, that I have a real, there's a friction there that clearly these people are having experiences, some that have been terrified out of their wits by encountering something strange.
Oh, and agreed. Yet, absolutely.
And yet, when you look at other aspects of it, you think, well, this can't possibly be a real creature, because what they're describing is so alien to our parameters of understanding the pot. You know, as we've said about perhaps ground sloths, giant ground sloths are still out there, or the Tasmanian tiger and some other relatives might be dotted around the Pacific. When we're talking about something like this, I think the fact that if, as you did, you come up with a very plausible explanation, because once again, as with anything, Pat, nature finds a way. Wolves and bears will get to places that people think, oh, well, we should be able to see them. But they're animals. They don't want you to see them. That's why they're still alive.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I agree. I think that it's, I wouldn't discount that somebody saw something, but I would say that it's most likely not this dog man type of scenario. And I feel bad saying that. I'm not going to tell someone that they're wrong or that they've, but when you do really talk to people who've seen this, there's a lot of things at play. There's adrenaline, there's fear, there's, you know, there's sometimes other substances that have been involved before it was sighted. A lot of times not. But sometimes there are, and they're, you know, just that adrenaline and that unknown and seeing something at night. And I think we've all been guilty of this, where you misinterpret what you're seeing. I mean, we have the pareidolia, I always forget what the word is, but where you see the characteristics of a face on something that doesn't
yes.
have a face.
Yep.
And it's human nature. It's part of our biology to see, you know, a human-like thing in something that isn't. And that's, that seems to me to be more of what the experience is that, you know, a bear with mange looks creepy. It looks really, really strange. They are much more likely to be around people because they're looking for an easy food source like bird food or a roadkill, something like that. They just look very – and they don't look like a bear. So even people who have seen bears, they see this and they're going to think that it's something else. And then your mind starts to go into all different directions to think of what this could be. I mean, I've seen a coyote late at night and was absolutely convinced that it was a wolf.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not. It's a coyote. but you can – you know, you make these lapses of, you know, something is – working in your mind that's telling you that this, you know, you need to get away from this. And once you have, and once you sit back and start to think about it, then it starts to get, you know, other characteristics added to it, and the stories can kind of evolve in your own head, I believe, in a lot of instances.
I must admit, it struck me probably about 10, 15 years ago, Pat. I remember reading an article about werewolf legends in Europe, and there's obviously a very famous woodcut, which is often included in any sort of documentary or article about werewolves, which shows that particular woodcut from, I don't know,
yes.
1750 with the creature standing up on two legs with a child in its mouth.
Yes.
And then I think about a year later, I saw a documentary about bears, and there was a bear in a river that stood up, wet through. And I thought, oh my God, it looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
And I suddenly began to think, are some of these, because obviously, you know, Europe is the ground zero when it comes to werewolf stories from around the world. This is where most of them came from. So, which this is going to be a very long-winded segue, Pat, to my next subject. But it's one of those creatures that seems to have been with us for a long time that has suddenly had a resurgence in the dogman in the modern era. And so, even though some people will say they're completely different, as I've touched on, and so when I looked at something like that, I could see somebody 300 years ago seeing a bear and a wet bear standing up on two legs eating something, thinking, what the hell is that?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And even now, we see there was the bear in New Jersey here in the States that had some kind of injury, so it walked upright
Pedals.
All the time. Yeah. And that looks weird. It looks very unusual, and it really throws you off. I mean, that's one of the other things about a ring pendek and other hairy hominids. Like, we are the only animal that should be bipedal
yeah.
in a human mind. And when you see something else walking on two legs, it throws you for a loop. It,
yeah.
You get very confused. Oh, what is happening? And when it's something like a bear, yeah, that throws you off. And I can absolutely see that, you know, at no fault of anyone's being misinterpreted as something very, very different.
Well, as I was straining to link, Pat, from werewolves to vampires. Obviously, one of the other episodes showed you going around the New England area, because this is one of those aspects as well, because I think most people have heard about the Mercy Brown.
Yes.
But what is it about New England that they had this history of vampires? Because Mercy Brown was probably the last vampire flap in the New England area. But there'd been several over the century previously where people were convinced that their relatives were going to come back from the grave. And it's a very strange aspect of that particular part of the United States. When you look at certain other areas where they've had large populations move over from Europe, and certain creatures have come with them, and there are wonderful legends from areas in New England, depending on the population of the country where these people originally moved from and their ancestors. And, you know, and as we mentioned, your great uncle Charles Fort, his family originated from the Netherlands, I believe. So, it, you know, Boston and that particular area has a big heritage with Ireland, and certain other parts with Scotland, and a lot of English people moved out there. But you've also got other European countries. So it's always been an interesting aspect of that particular part of the US that it seems so ingrained to have this vampire flap throughout the late 18th and 19th centuries.
It was so much more prevalent than I ever imagined. As you said, I'd heard about the Mercy Brown case, and that was what really turned me on to this. And I pitched this idea as one of the episodes. But it was so much more prevalent than I had thought. And it was such a kind of wild and unique story. And also the fact that the New England vampires are what may have inspired, or definitely had an inspiration on Bram Stoker, which was crazy to me as well. But that was kind of a trigger in his mind when he read that. But the New England vampires were so different than I think what we think of as the classic vampire stories. It was really more of this, Puritan idea of something draining your essence, draining your life force, and more of what they would, like the modern day vampires would call like a psi vampire, a psionic vampire, more so than drinking the blood, which we associate with the European vampires.
Yeah.
And it really, you can see the complete parallels with tuberculosis. And you can see the tuberculosis coming over on the ships from Europe. And with tuberculosis came the stories of vampires. And they take off in the same way. When you see an uptick in TB cases, that's when you see an uptick in this, case of vampirism or of suspected vampirism. And that then along with that also came these histories and kind of wish that we could forget them, stories of medicinal cannibalism. And a friend of mine, Dr. Richard Sugg, wrote this amazing book on medicinal cannibalism in the 16th and 15th up to the 19th century.
Yeah.
And just how how widespread this was and how accepted it was in the medical community and in the religious communities, that consuming a part of somebody that was harming you, could potentially cure all these different diseases. And at beheadings and other public executions, there would be sick people crowded around the corpse to drink the fresh blood from the corpse that has just had the head removed.
Yes.
And this was a totally normal and accepted thing, and even published in medical literature. So this kind of tradition, as much as people would like to forget about it and pretend that this wasn't prevalent in Western societies, it was. And these cases of medicinal vampirism in New England seems to just be a carryover of that. Seems to be like maybe it was losing popularity in Europe, but here in the US they had something that they were facing that they didn't know what to do about, tuberculosis, and they went back to the old ways.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting when I have read some European flaps, Pat, that are based on this. Some of the things they would do, if they believed that there was a vampire, they would cut the body open and they would mix the blood with the earth of the grave, which,
yeah,
you look at it now in the modern era and you think, what the hell are you doing there? You know, that's one way to make yourself ill. If you're drinking the blood of corpses mixed with earth, I think there's a good chance you're going to get some kind of infection. And yet,
yes,
that's what people thought they needed to do. And so it the thing that's always surprised me is, why did it just happen? It seemed to be most prevalent in the New England area. Did you kind of get any more sort of insight into why it was there? Do you think it was just the people that were living there and where they'd come from that they'd got this history with them, whereas perhaps further down south, people had come from sort of Spain and places like that, where the vampire myth wasn't so ingrained in their popular culture.
Yeah, I do. I think that it was part of that. I think it was part of the traditions of medicinal cannibalism also seemed to come over more with the folks that settled in New England. Mm. And the instances of TB, there seemed to be more tuberculosis in the northern areas than there were in the other regions. I mean, when people got TB, you know, later when people got TB, they would move to other, they'd move to a drier climate or, you know, a warmer climate and think that that was going to help, because it was just more prevalent in the New England area. So I really think it all kind of centered around tuberculosis. And we weren't able to film everything that we wanted to on that one. There was some really cool ties back with some marine biology aspects of seals and other things like that. That seals being a carrier for TB, you know, potentially. And, you know, but it has unfortunately led to a lot of seal culls in other places from people being really terrified of this. And they shouldn't be. Yeah. But it's so we weren't able to explore kind of every aspect of it just based on the time of a, you know, 42-minute show. But it was interesting, and it got me down to New Orleans, which is one of my favorites. It is, you know, my Boston's my favorite city in the U.S., and New Orleans is a very close second.
Yeah. So obviously you're about to hit the bookshelves with a collection of books based on your experiences and your adventures behind the shows that we saw during the Beast Hunter. So when did that germination come? Was that something you've been wanting to do for a while, Pat? Because as I was joking before we started the interview, my family are really delighted that I've added 6 books to my Christmas list so close to December.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It's something that, so when I was filming Beast Hunter, I kept a journal and was writing, and the head of Icon Films, Harry Marshall, suggested that, you know, maybe down the road it would be a good idea to write a book. He read some of my writings and he liked it, and he thought that this would be, you know, something that would be beneficial. And then when I'm like a golden retriever, I always need a job. I need something to keep me focused. And when I was recovering during chemo and after, Harry and Laura Marshall sent me a laptop and said, here, you know, this is to write your book. And I just thought that that was such an amazing gesture. And I started writing it right then. And in very Pat Spain fashion, it blew up to about 800 pages, which I knew was way too much. So I shopped it around for a number of years and found a publisher. I knew it needed a lot of editing. And after about a year of back and forth with the publisher that I found, who have been great, John Hunt Publications, they said, you know, we really don't see anything that we can cut, but 800 pages is too much. What if we made this into a series? And, you know, if you could actually beef it up, do you think you could write a little bit more? So we went back, you know, I broke it up into 6 books. I worked with a couple different editors and a couple different, a number of different editors, and broke the things up into what made sense into these, you know, other volumes, and beefed them up, wrote a few other things. They wanted to hear expanded versions of certain stories. And that's really what the books are. The books are the reality behind traveling, the reality behind being in these places. They're dark comedies. All of them have an animal chapter, a crypto chapter in them, but it's really this kind of interesting mix. And I make a joke about it in the books. I say, well, you know, congratulations, you've reached the crypto chapter. This is either a very weird part of the travel book that you bought, or you're finally into the thing that you wanted to read. Because they're kind of intended as a they're short. They're only about 150 pages each. But they're something where, you know, if someone's traveling to Sumatra, this is something they could grab on the plane and get kind of a laugh as they're on their way there and learn about the culture, learn about the place, learn about, you know, my experiences being a fish out of water in all of these wild places.
Absolutely. I always chuckle about the West African particular project, because one of the funniest aspects of that was that you were nearly arrested because of your trousers. Because
I was.
you made the fashion mistake of wearing combats, which clearly marked you out as a member of the militia, Pat.
Oh man, so we're in this border town between the Congo and Cameroon, and border towns are so interesting to me. But I'm filming on a long lens, so the whole crew is way far behind me, and I'm filming and walking around, and all of a sudden this man walks up to me and grabs my pants and starts screaming at me in French. I was like, what's going on? Like, dude, leave me alone. What's happening? And the guy gets really angry and just storms off. So I was like, that's weird. And then another person does it. And then the third person who came over was in a uniform, and he screams at me and starts yelling. And I'm just apologizing. I don't know what's going on. And he goes, French. It's like, no, I'm sorry. I don't speak French. I'm really bad at languages. My wife is Vietnamese. I don't even speak Vietnamese. And I'm just mumbling. And, you know, the guy goes, oh, English? I was like, yes, I speak English. And he goes, English is the language of Barack Obama. It is a good language. And I said, oh, I voted for him. And he goes, you are the reason Barack Obama is president? I said, yes, I am. Yes. And then we were best of friends. And then everything was okay. I wasn't going to get arrested. He had been threatening to throw me in jail. And, you know, everything was fine. And I kind of make the joke that no matter who you support politically in that moment, you would have absolutely been the reason that Barack Obama was president. But it was, it was a terrifying, the most scared that I ever was on all of the shoots involved, you know, almost getting arrested or almost dying in a car.
Yeah.
Those are the moments.
Yeah. So you've got a little Bigfoot, 200,000 snakes, which is a crazy experience, a living dinosaur, bulletproof ground sloths, sea serpents, and the Mongolian death worm. So there's travelogues, as you say, with a chapter focusing on the particular creature. I do like the sub headings as well, obviously. The living dinosaur one, how you avoided prison but was outsmarted by a snail as well, Pat. Yes. Which is, you're very humble in telling people how you've come a cropper on some of these trips.
Oh, these books are very humbling. I do not come across as brave or anything or smart in any of them. It's all the reality of it. The funniest thing to me was that, you know, I always look like this big, tough explorer. And Barney, the series producer, said that the hardest part of his job was making me look cool. And that is 100% true. I am awkward and strange. And yeah, so it's these books really tell you what it was really like and what my actual thoughts are and what was happening.
Yeah.
But the subtitles are kind of my little homage to Dr. Strangelove, or, you know, how I learned to stop fearing and love the bomb. So each one is how I something. And that was the intention, was you get a little taste. So you see the brave and the crazy, you know, and the sea serpent, but then you get the little, you know, caveat of, well, this is what Pat Spain's really like.
Yeah, absolutely.
How I found the worst bathroom on earth, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's good to know just how bad 200,000 snakes do make you smell afterwards, Pat.
I had to sell my car. Genuinely. I got back to Boston and sold my car the next week. And it was not good.
Oh, well, I'm delighted to see that you've hit the bookshelves with these books. Where can everybody keep up to date with you online and get the books and follow your work? And what's next for you, Pat?
Thank you so much. So my website is patspain.com. I am Pat Spain on Instagram. That's where I'm the most active. I know I have a Facebook, but I haven't been on it in a very long time. So Instagram's where I'm the most active on social media, patspain.com. And you can find all the books on Amazon. So if you just search On the Hunt, and Pat Spain, they'll all pop up. And my favorite thing about Amazon is the interesting subcategories that they put you in. So I had the number one book on Amazon in the category of New Mongolia Travel Guides.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, so they're a lot of fun. And what's next is, you know, getting these books out there in December and January, and kind of a rolling dates here in the U.S. And then I'm not sure the next adventures. I have my day job, and that keeps me very busy, and my two amazing kids who keep me very, very busy, and I'm getting them excited about wildlife. So I'm kind of outside a lot with the two of them, teaching them all about animals and learning from them as they get to experience them for the first time. So those are my main focuses right now, are family.
Brilliant. So if there's one creature, if I gave you a blank check tomorrow, Pat, and there's one creature you've not had the pleasure of doing a TV show on, where would you go?
Tasmanian tiger, no doubt.
Good answer.
Absolutely. With every possibility of it being there, an amazing location, an amazing story, the new eDNA. Mm-hmm. I would use that blank check to get the best eDNA test kit that I could and spend about a month, and I really think we'd find one.
Fabulous. Pat, it's been an absolute pleasure to finally speak to you. Don't be a stranger. I wish you the very best of luck with everything in your life and your career. And I hope we get the chance to speak again in the future, my friend. You take care.
I hope so as well. Thank you so much. This was awesome.